The truth can no longer be hidden. Ukraine will suffer a strategic loss, a battlefield loss, to the Russian Federation. Now, if you've been watching our channel for any amount of time, you're like, wait, what? That's what you say every week. Exactly. That is what we say all the time. Have since from the very beginning of our channel. I was saying it on radio and television and in print media from the beginning of the war, as have lots of other people who have been looking at it as it exists, as the reality is. But now then we're starting to get some movement on this to where even other people who have historically been on the Ukraine side and didn't want to look at that, even now some of them are saying, okay, we can't hide this any longer. Ukraine's going to lose. And this is coming primarily from Julian Ripka, who is, we've cited a number of times on here, he's definitely pro-Ukraine, has still wanted to put kind of a positive spin on things throughout a lot of times. But among the journalists in the West, he has been, to his credit, one who has been willing to put forth the truth on a lot of things. But even now, he is now saying, there's no more covering this over. And as we're going to see in this episode here, unfortunately, that memo has not gotten to a lot of the leaders in the West, definitely in Europe, definitely in Ukraine itself. What a shock there. And it remains to be seen whether any of this is going to have any impact on American leaders. They've been kind of silent on this, been sort of distracted with stuff like the shutdown or the Epstein files. More on that in another video. But at least on this, they haven't been saying much of anything here lately. That doesn't change the fact on the ground, though, that the reality remains as it has been and is now picking up steam. And what led, I think, Julian to say this is the fact that it is picking up steam on the ground. And one of the issues that we, many people on the West love to cite, Emmanuel Macron has been one, General, what's his name? Jack Keane, of course, and Ben Hodges, the favorite one. They've often said, well, Russia's hardly taken any territory at all. They've just been taking a little. Well, now we told you all the way through that Russia's primarily focus was on the destruction of the Ukrainian armed forces. That's what Russia was trying to get at. And it wasn't taking territory is important, but it's a secondary objective. The destruction of the Ukrainian armed forces is first and foremost. But now then we see that in addition to destroying the Ukrainian armed forces, and we're going to specify those new numbers as well, it's now then because of that, they are accelerating in their capture of territory. And it's now in the realm of possibility where they could have even more and larger losses as we get further into the winter in this 2025, 2026, and possibly even into the spring. Let's get into what Julian Ripka said. I want to get right up in this. He says, listen, the situation can no longer be glossed over by PR actions from the Ukrainian general staff, nor sugarcoating or ignoring on the part of the government of Kiev. Ukraine is heading towards a strategic defeat against Russia's invasion forces. And listen, that's self-evident. It's true. And I'm going to show you here in a little bit the actual map. And we're going to see just since the last time I did a tactical update and talked about some things toward the end of last week, just over the weekend, there have been meaningful changes across the front line in many of the cases. But the fact that he is calling these folks out, he's saying, listen, it's the Ukraine general staff. So a lot of these reports that come out, it's just we're putting sugarcoat on. The Ukrainian government, he specifies those folks right there, that they're not dealing straight with the public. They're not dealing straight with the European public, with the American public, or their own public. And the longer you go ignoring the reality, I mean, it's this is not too far off the point here. It's like someone who has cancer. I don't want them to have cancer. No one wants anyone to have cancer. It's a terrible thing. So I'm just going to ignore it and pretend like they're fine. They just got the cold. They'll be fine. Don't worry about it. No, don't go to the doctor. No, don't do any kind of treatments on that. No chemotherapy. Don't worry about anything. They're fine. Don't worry about it. What's going to happen to that patient? Is the cancer going to go away by itself? Pretty unlikely. And when you can actually have medical reports like month by month and you see that the patient is deteriorating and you still won't say, no, they don't have cancer, man. Everything's fine. It's a good deal. They just have a little sniffles. It happens this time of year, you know. You're going to be presiding over the destruction and the death of that patient. That's what we're doing here, folks. And by this continual unwillingness to acknowledge patent, clear ground truth reality, we are ensuring that Ukrainian men will continue to die, territory will be lost, cities will be destroyed, and ultimately the Russians will move further to the west. Congratulations. I don't think that's what we had in mind, but that's what we're having with our actions. Moving down on the list, let's look at some of the details of why he says this. One of the issues there, he's talking about the tanks. He says, more than 2,000 delivered tanks, armored personnel carriers, and armored vehicles are largely useless in the face of Russia's growing dominance in fiber optic guided and other drone systems. Now, you've heard for many, many, many months, especially over the last year or so, that the Ukraine side and many of their advocates talk about how they have a dominance in the drones, and they have had all this new technology, and that they've silenced a lot on the Russian side, and they're just leaving the Russians in the dust. Remember that many, many times in the West talking about that. It's never been true. There have been times when the balance was roughly even. One side might have a little advantage over the other, and it would tip back and forth. But we've been telling you for the majority of this year that the balance tipped now in the Russian side, and it only continues going in their positive direction for the Russians. And when you ignore that, when you can see that the Ukrainian, and listen, let me be clear on here, Ukraine is doing incredible work. There is unbelievable amounts of courage and bravery on their head and skill in fighting. Let me add that in there too. They're not a bad fighting force at all, but they have too few troops. And they have two, because they don't have even air superiority, they don't have air parity even though people love to mock the Russian air forces for not having air superiority, they do. They don't have air supremacy, Russia doesn't, but they do and have from the beginning had air superiority, and that people trying to lie about that never helped anything. Russia just figured out there's no point in us flying over the front line when our standoff weapon systems can get the job done and doesn't even give the Western side a chance to shoot the aircraft down. So they don't do too much tactical air anymore. I haven't seen any evidence of that in probably about a year. Maybe there has been, but it's been pretty small. But their standoff stuff is routine in every single night. In fact, let me look at something here to give you the current update. This is as of this morning. If I can pull this up here. Yes, here we go. So Russia, this is in the past 24 hours, conducted 66 airstrikes, dropping 164 glide bombs, 4,122 attacks with artillery and other multiple launch rocket systems, and 4,082 kamikaze drones. Folks, that's just in 24 hours. So something like those lines are every day. So if you want to mock Russia for not having air superiority, and yet you can't come close to matching the amount of airstrikes that the Russians have, and you cannot stop the ones that the Russia has. That doesn't even count all of the strategic drones and the missile forces that Russia fires every day. That's just on the tactical front. And so now then you have the Ukraine side is on the minority. And because of that superiority, because of the drones at both the tactical and operational level and the airstrikes and then the strategic level drones, they're hitting throughout the Ukrainian depth all the way up to the western border. Well, all of that inhibits things getting to the front. Every time you get a factory going, every time you get something of any size, as soon as Russia figures it out and finds out where it is through their intelligence apparatus, they hit it. And you can't stop them from hitting it because the air defense capacity on the Ukraine side is inadequate to the task. And so that limits how much they can get. And the West is not able to make up the difference. With all of the defense industrial base that the West is doing, with all the money they've offered, it still is not overcoming what the Russians are doing primarily by themselves. So that is the big issue there. And when you don't have the drones, as Julian talks about there, even if you have thousands, and apparently they do, thousands of tanks and armored personnel carriers, they're pointless. They don't help because that's not the way this modern war is fought. You recall last week, we showed you this image in Pokrovsk where Russia was moving a fairly large number of troops out in the open because they had cover of fog. So that limits drones, fiber optics or not. Either side has that limitation. Even Russia still is limited because they're in the advantage, but Ukraine still has very potent capabilities. And if Russia foolishly acts on the battlefield, they'll certainly pay a blood price for it. But when they have the cover, they were able to move. And you noticed, and we pointed out at the time, we didn't see a single armored vehicle in there. Russia has tens of thousands of armored vehicles, not just in the thousands, but tens of thousands. But they're not using them right now because of the way the war is being fought at the moment. And that's a huge, an important thing to point out. Right now, it's not in their advantage to do so because of the drone capability on the Ukraine side is still very potent. But these things can actually work, whether it's motorcycles, just regular vehicles that can drive more maneuverable, and they're more vulnerable. You can get rid of them. You can lose them without it much cost. You can get them replaced fairly easily, etc. That's how modern war is being fought. So it's pointing out that the Ukraine side, doesn't matter how many tanks or armored personnel carriers they have, that's not going to help them because they can't change the balance in the air. And so even though they're trying the same things the Russians are, they don't have as many men. And you may recall, if you've watched this channel for any amount of time, we've been saying literally since our first show, it's about men. It's not about machines. It's not about money per se. It's no matter how much of the other two categories you have, that's the one right there. That's modern warfare right there, folks. That's not a Mad Max kind of ding on the Russians. That's what works right now. And so they're doing what works, and you're seeing all across the front line the payoff for what they're doing. So you can mock them all day long, but they are still advancing, and the Ukraine side can't stop them. Next thing we move into, in fact, it's more on this drone issue here. He says that they're in the modern, what he called weapons of mass destruction, which is in the modern sense, that is millions of FPV drones, as well as thousands of powerful cruise missiles for deep strikes. Western nations continue to limit themselves to spotty aid and investments in strategically overestimated Ukrainian long-range drones. So he's saying, listen, if y'all want to do something that's going to help Ukraine, you should have put millions, plural, of drones in their hands, et cetera, all across the front line. But instead, then you didn't give a lot of the powerful cruise missiles. Now, of course, he's not a statesman. He's just a journalist. And so he didn't have to worry about the consequence of giving those things. And of course, I am worried about the strategic consequences. And if you had given all these long-range weapons and they had worked, then you had the very real possibility of having the war expanded. So it's not a neutral issue, and there's a reason why the West didn't do that part. The drones may be a separate issue because that didn't have the strategic problem per se, but they just didn't have the capacity. They just didn't have it. But then the other issue is, he points out correctly again, that, listen, this strategically overestimated Ukraine long-range drones. So many times they keep talking about these new drones that the Ukraine's building. They wanted these other long-range fires from the U.S. They had the Storm Shadow. They had the ATACMS and all those kinds of things. And we were also saying, look, you see the Russian has almost unlimited, well, not unlimited, but they have a significant number of long-range drones and long-range missiles that they have continued to be able to keep in the air and has caused significant damage throughout Ukraine, but it hasn't been enough to knock them out. And the idea that you would have enough of those on the Ukraine side to knock out the much larger and much more geographically dispersed Russia and with just a trinket and a few of them, it was never going to happen that way. So we're starting to get into the point here to why we've been saying on this channel that this was an unwinnable war for the Ukraine side and why it's a war you can't even avoid losing. And this is the reason why. So when you see that you're not going to get the millions of drones, when you can see that the governments of the West aren't going to give the long-range fires that could draw them into the war, and you see that all the armored vehicles and tanks and everything else you gave aren't working, you see the point. Hang on a second. Then why keep going down a path that can only fail? Now, we're not even talking, he didn't mention in this article here about the sanctions and all that. When you layer over all that the economic level of warfare that the West has tried to do has just been a mockery of failure, and they continue to do it. Now trying to do the 20th when the first 19 packages, plus the Americans, one of the last ones that the U.S. side did, never worked, and now they're trying basically number 21. And I don't even know what you think is going to happen after 21 when the first 20 didn't work. But nevertheless, that's continued to be where we are. Moving on there. One of the things I do want to point out at this point, he talked about that the West is focused on the wrong kinds of things, not the millions of drones. Well, that is currently the case and continues to this literal day. France announced today that they're going to give 100 fighter jets to the Ukraine side here. And they're like, hey, that'll help out. I know that they need a lot of drones, but we're going to give them 100 fighter jets. And Gary, if you could put that full screen up, this is from I think this is a New York Times here today. France pledged on Monday to sell up to 100 Rafael fighter jets to Ukraine in a show of European support, as the Trump administration has limited its military backing for the country. Just a little dig to the U.S. there. The agreement, which includes a range of French defense and equipment in addition to the warplanes, will have a limited immediate effect on the Ukraine war against Russia. The timeline for delivering the system extends to 2035. So, as we talked about, now look at those smiles. Oh, man, they're happy. That is so good. This is the literal embodiment of what Julian Rupke is talking about, the unwillingness to acknowledge reality. All these smiles and this great stuff, like this is going to matter, and these cool pictures, these jets behind, and all these service members back there. It's just embarrassing. Remember when the whole thing was about the F-16s, the U.S. fighters? You remember when, it was Senator Blumenthal and Senator Lindsey Graham were just crowing from a press conference in Ukraine. I think it might have been 2023 or 2024. I can't remember. But they were talking about how, man, we need to get those jets in and get them there fast, and that'll turn the war around or whatever. They ended up getting them. Crickets afterwards. Made no difference whatsoever. Because the issue isn't so much the planes as it is the system that which in the planes fight with when the United States, when we can use them effectively. It's because they're within integrated into a defense system. You've got guys literally decades of training. You have a pipeline that's going to continue. You have the guys from their second lieutenant time when they first get commissioned all the way up through colonel and generals in some cases, where they're fighting these things, and they have the system that goes and develops the fighter pilots, et cetera. All that is an integrated system. You can't just toss a few jets out there and say guys who trained on a Soviet level of aircraft are suddenly going to be able to fight effectively with Americans or French, as the case is. And then even that, you're talking 10 freaking years. And why are you going to be patting yourself on the back when that means you're going to get a handful of fighters, and then you're going to have the same issue here? You're going to have to train guys on how to fight the Rafael fighter, just like they did with the F-16s. You may remember that the Biden administration approved the F-16s, but it was, I forget the exact, 6, 8, 9 months, something like that, a long time from the time it was authorized until the first ones were in the air, because you had to train the pilots up. So now we're going to start that clock over again on the Rafael fighters. Unless maybe somebody's been doing something behind the scenes and they're only now announcing it. Maybe they are. I don't know. But even that won't matter, because the number is going to be too small, and the Russians still have the air defense capabilities. The same reason why their Soviet fighters didn't work against Russia the first time, the same reason why the F-16s didn't have any impact either, is the same thing will be effective for the Rafael fighters. That's just self-evident. Not hard to figure that out. And yet we're congratulating ourselves and slapping each other on the back and smiling, shaking hands and all that on something that's not even useful. That's not the problem. Julian Rupke was accurate in his assessment. It is in the drone situation right now. That's why Russia is moving to the West. But they're going to move on from there. Next, he's going to get to the issue that I told you is the heart of it, is it the manpower? And he says that the Ukraine side is allegedly force mobilizing 17,000 men per month. But then how much is being deployed is actually a mystery. And listen, this is the issue here, because the very next paragraph there, he's talking about desertions and temporary absences of duty remains largely unpunished. This leads not only to misjudgment of one's own troop strength and resilience, but also massive gaps in the front lines. And as a result, to ever newer Russian breakthroughs. So I don't remember if it was Stanislav or Andrei Mardianov we had on last week, but they said that probably the number of mobilized Ukrainians that would be needed to offset losses to stabilize the front is probably around 60,000 per month. 60,000. They might have 17,000 with Julian Rupke. So as far as I know, this is the first I've seen in any Western media actually putting a number to what they're getting. I think we estimated it might be as few as 25,000, which should still be just a bare fraction of what was necessary. But it's probably even less than that. And even that, he says, is probably not the right number. Who knows what it actually is? And then you factor on the desertions on top of that, which means that whatever that 17,000 you get, some number of desertions are going to come, and apparently it's not a small number of that, then we'll leave each month. And then, of course, on top of that, you have all of the casualties that are inflicted by the Russians against Ukraine. So all that's a net-net. There's almost no way that this can be anything except a shrinking army each month. And, of course, not just the numeric, which is a problem all its own, but also the qualitative aspect, because every time you get somebody that's got some experience, they'll end up getting killed off. And so the guys that build up some experience, they get killed off before they get a chance to pass that on to the next troops. And then you restart that clock. And so you see that the amount of experience keeps shrinking because you don't have the time to train them up. You don't have the time for them to survive long enough to get the combat in sufficient quantities to then make an impact, meaningful difference anywhere on the battlefield. And as I've also pointed out in recent weeks, because there's not enough troops to man that whole line, that they now don't have the fire brigades, the reinforcements that they would have, that if there's a penetration anywhere or if there's Russians are starting to have some success here, that they'll move that fire brigade down and reinforce whatever's on the front line. We suspected that with that last one that they were trying to do, the Ukraine side north of Pokrovsk, that might have been their last one. And then therefore there's not room, there's no more anywhere else. And we suspected that we would then start seeing larger advances elsewhere on the front. And that's exactly what we've seen. I'm going to get to that in just a second. As I've also pointed out earlier, one of the complaints and the mocking on the Russian side that so many in the West have done for months now is that Russia hasn't gained any meaningful, sufficient territory. Well, as it turns out, according to Julian Rurka there, Ukraine lost 586 square kilometers in the month of October. 586 square kilometers in October. Not a minor number. But then he says the really important part. He says that in November, annual high in territory losses is likely to be reached. This month brings the monthly loss on a scale of the German state of Berlin within reach. Russian offensives in the regions of the major cities of Dnipro and Zaporizhia are thus only a matter of months. Only a matter of months. And just for your knowledge, the German state of Berlin, not the city, but the whole state, their region, sort of like a state, just a little under 900 square kilometers. And that would represent a new low or a new loss, high, actually, for the Ukraine side. A new record. So since, say, January 2023, when Russia went on the defensive after the first year, you can't really count the first few months because that was when you just had this massive influx. But since that time, since the Ukraine offensives of 2022 and the push the Russians back in Kharkiv and out of Kherson City, et cetera, since that happened from that time, so really late 2022, this is the highest month that we're in right now. So that means it's picked up speed in last month and then now is going to come close possibly to being doubled in this month. And as we then get into, we're still in the muddy, rainy season now. As we get into the frozen area, it's entirely possible that Russia could advance even faster. And especially as the winter has set in and the Ukraine side has lost a significant portion of its heating capacity, of its energy capacity, it's going to put the morale even lower because it's going to be harder to keep those troops fed, to keep them reinforced, to keep them warm in those bitter, bitter cold, whereas the Russians apparently have a lot less problems in those areas. And their logistics are now very well oiled machine. They can get their stuff that they need. And even though Ukraine has some spotty shots into the Russian hinterland, it's an annoyance, but it's not a systemic issue that's going to cause any kind of capacity problems at the front line, despite whatever Zelensky may claim. So that's the issue. So now you have the manpower. Now that the manpower is turning into loss of territory accelerating, and it could even include the cities of Dnipro and Zaporizhia, which are new areas of fighting. And so then we get to what he says is the bottom line here. It remains the case if neither the government in Kiev nor its Western partners immediately initiate a strategic turnaround, Russia will win this war piece by piece. Now, you may recall two or three weeks back, I showed you that one of the reports from the Times of London, one of their editors said the same. He said that I don't see how that Kiev can remain in control of the Ukraine even toward the end of the spring. So Ripka is not the only one that's been observing this, but the leaders are remain just as oblivious to this. I'm going to show you the battlefront in a minute to see exactly what has led Ripka to making these comments here. But I want to show, first of all, that his comment there, that unless the West turns this around and acknowledges reality, they're basically cementing in a physical loss on the Ukraine side. Let me show you that as of today, there has been no such evidence of that. Here is earlier, I just mentioned that France offered 100 jets to Ukraine. Well, here is the comment by the leader of France, Emmanuel Macron, when he announced what their objectives are. Watch this.
Monsieur le Président, cher Volodymyr, je veux ici vous redire, à travers vous aussi au peuple ukrainien, que la France reste à vos côtés. Ensemble, avec nos partenaires, nous continuerons d'agir en faveur de la paix, d'une paix juste, durable, conforme au droit international, assurant la sécurité d'une Ukraine souveraine, indépendante, libre et européenne.
Oh, yeah, that's so heartfelt, and a freedom and peace and a just and sustainable peace. And we're right with you the whole time. But yeah, you're going to be right with them the whole time to loss. And then on the day the Russian forces now pause a collapse somewhere and people are just in panic and start, you know, free fall running, which is inevitable at some point. It's just a mathematical certainty. It's got to happen at some point. You just can't keep going on like this forever. The Ukraine side, who were having all the negatives I just mentioned, it's going to happen at some point. And then what will France do? It won't be a French territory being overrun. It won't be French soldiers being killed. It won't be French civilians dying. France will go, huh. Anyway, I got to go back to Paris. And that'll be it. And they'll just shrug their shoulders and they'll blame Russia and they'll blame whoever else, who knows what. There's always going to be somebody else at fault here. But then they'll just say, you know what, we need to double down on our defense. And I can only imagine that the French military, that the French government will say, oh, my God, see, the big warning is just watch for this to happen. Oh, my God, here they're going to all come to us next. And now we have to spend a lot more money on defense because we'll be the next, even though there is no evidence that Russia wants to do that, has any interest in doing that or capacity to do that. As many of our guests have shown here in recent months, especially those who have some knowledge about Russia, they are self-sufficient. They don't need to come in to conquer anything. This is not like a Hitler moment to where he had written Mein Kampf and they knew that Russia had or Germany had territorial acquisitions outside of their aspirations, outside of their country, that they had talked about it. They had a military infrastructure capable of doing it and that there were no nuclear weapons in existence at the time. So nothing that could potentially stop that. That's not the case today. Russia doesn't have the capacity to wage a war of conquest conventionally into Western Europe, nor do they have any interest in doing so because it would be absurd to the highest degree because they can't gain anything by it. They already have what they need. Why would they want to take over a bunch of countries that right now, even in their current state, are economic dead weights and would be a drain on the society, much less the fact that you would have to garrison all these places for years into the future, millions of people, and you would have all kinds of fighting going on at the insurgent level, et cetera. There's no doubt that would happen. Why would Russia ever do that? They don't have any interest in doing that and would lose a lot. But what they do want is to weaken the West and make them see, don't come towards us. We're going to secure our Western border. And now then they would stop because they have a performing economy, et cetera. And they don't have their troops that would be dying anymore after that war had been concluded. So there's ever a rational, logical reason they would do that. They've never said anything to the contrary, as Hitler did. So, but that's not going to matter because the facts haven't mattered for the last nearly 4 years. Why would they start to matter now for the West? But if we've gone on these basically suicidal and self-defeating policies up to this point, I don't know why they would stop. Although the hope is that when enough of this reality, that enough people, and Julian Ripka is one example of them who's finally said, look, I've been trying to be as optimistic as I can, but if I'm going to have a conscience, I can't keep doing it. I bet he won't be the only one. The hope is that enough of those people in these various countries will rise up and say, quit making it more likely we get into a war with Russia we don't need to fight, etc. We'll see how that's going to work out. Macron's not the only one. And at the head of this list is brother Volodymyr Zelensky.
Такі сильні коаліції, які колись були, українські українці, які ніколи не були до цього моменту. Українці дали цей об'єднавчий імпульс. Саме такий імпульс Європі, іншим в світі, і ми отримуємо допомогу завдяки цьому. Єдність працює, саме тому ми можемо збивати російські ракети, ми можемо зупиняти російські штурми щоденно на фронті. Ми відновлюємо нашу енергетику, нам дуже важко, дуже складно, але ми все це відновлюємо, нашу інфраструктуру, коли Росія її руйнує. І найголовніше, ми даємо також іншим націям надію, що Росія їй не вдасться зробити новою нормою війни.
Wow. That's a new high or a new low, depending on how you want to look at it, even for Volodymyr Zelensky. So he's sitting there saying that Ukraine is forming a unifying moment for all of Europe. It's drawing all these nations together in a way that they hadn't before. And that's a good thing. And by the way, when Russia's trying to hit us with rockets, we're shooting rockets down. When they're advancing on the front lines, we're pushing them back. And when they're trying to destroy our infrastructure, we're rebuilding it back up. And bottom line is, we are going forward, and we are going to ultimately make sure that Russia can't succeed at to having any success with this war. Not a word he said is true. Not a thing in there about you don't have enough men to even maintain your army. You are shrinking every single month. You're losing hundreds of square kilometers, possibly in the thousands by the end of this month here, each month. And your energy infrastructure is being ground to dust. And even Secretary of State Marco Rubio admitted last week that over the last several years, you're continuing to lose percentages that can't be replaced. And so the next winter, it starts at a lower case and then goes further and further down. And even he said, and what's the point of giving you defensive weapons when a week after we give these new systems in there, they're destroyed? I don't know if that was a slip of the tongue or maybe an intentional comment that we're not doing any of that. So this idea that we're unified, you have the United States has stopped giving anything to Ukraine. They said we're going to sell stuff, and that's been kind of on the back burner for a while. You haven't heard about any new things there. And what you did hear just last week was Secretary Rubio saying, I don't even see what the point is of giving you this kind of stuff. I guess we'll sell some other stuff and make some money. And that's the United States. But then you have Slovakia and Hungary are not quite as unified as France.
European politics intellectually is very sophisticated, but what they are saying basically means that they would not like to have a peace just now. They would like to continue the war. They think, and they speak about it publicly, that we have to continue the war to support Ukraine more. The situation will improve on the front line, and we will have a better circumstances or preconditions for negotiation. Wrong, totally wrong. Not to speak about geopolitics and human dimension, economically and financially is just crazy. We finance a country which has no chance to win the war, but at the same time, there's a high level of corruption.
Yeah. I mean, Viktor Orban has never shied away from saying the truth. And I know a lot of people in Europe are not fans of Viktor Orban. They don't like him. But at least on this foreign policy issue, he has been right from the beginning. And he is not exaggerated. He has been very clear on the very fundamental reasons why he said that. You remember, I think it was a week or so ago, he was in Washington, and he was saying something nearly as categorical that the Ukraine side can't win. And standing right next to Trump, you may remember that one awkward question. They said, wait, are you saying that Ukraine can't win? Can Ukraine not win this war at all? And he hesitated. He kind of looked over at Trump, and he said, well, I guess a miracle is always possible. Because, he didn't want to upstage Trump, I guess. Who knows what was said behind the scenes, but you see here in this interview, he had no such hesitation. He said, you can't win this war. Why should we give economics? Why should we give weapons? Why should we give support? And then he just added that last part there about this corruption. And I don't have any of the sound bites right in front of me, but you may be well aware that there is a major corruption scandal exploded. People in Ukraine are actually turning against Zelensky. One report I saw just this morning said that his approval rating is down to 20%, which is a dramatic drop from just recent times, because there's been a revelation that one of his closest confidants has been directly engaged in an $100 million scandal. And as Larry Johnson said on our show here recently, that's almost small potatoes compared to the, I think it was $48 billion other scandal that's being in research right now. This is from just a couple of months ago when Zelensky, apparently aware that he was being investigated, tried to disband. It's called the NABU, their anti-corruption organizations. He tried to disband them, and there was such an uproar that he had to reinitiate them, but put some handcuffs on them, basically. But even that didn't work, and God only knows how much is really at stake here, how much has really gone out. And the bottom line, though, is everything you want to look at, you see that Volodymyr Zelensky is interested in getting more money and more support, and he never stops doing that, even though, as Viktor Orban correctly states, this war militarily cannot be won, and this war, and I'll go a little bit further and say that the Ukraine side cannot avoid defeat. That is pretty close to what Julian Rybka has now said. Ukraine will lose this war, and it's picking up speed, and it could come sooner. Let me show you graphically probably what led Julian Rybka to this conclusion. This is the map here. I want to go over several key areas just since the last time I gave you an update toward the end of last week. And we're going to start down in Zaporizhia area. So here's Zaporizhia City. There has been continued advancement up in the in this area here, up along these waterways, where I think the last time we showed you, this was in the red zone. There's some gray zone. Now then, this has gone all the way up into Primorsk, is now in the gray zone where the Russian forces continued advancing there. And again, because there's not any of these fire brigades, it's unclear that the Ukraine has enough troops to prevent Russia from getting. You see, it's not far at all into the outskirts of the city of Zaporizhia. So the Russians continue pushing up here in the south. Then we continue to move over toward the further up the western, the eastern front. And you see around the city of Orkhiv here, the settlement of Malotachmachka has now been taken by the Russians. And now then they're nearly on the outskirts of Orkhiv itself. This is another place where the Ukrainian side has been dug in. And once this is taken here, then like so many of these other places, the Russians can start moving up in a pincer movement to cut off the supply route here. They're already on the exertion. They definitely have visibility and fire control over these roads here in the south, so it won't be much before they can get this. And then all of these folks here that are defending along this, where the front line is, will also be surrounded, and something we see happening a lot lately. Let's move up a little bit more here to Guliapolia. There has been additional advances here. I think the last time I showed you, this was in the gray zone. This has now turned into Russian territory outright, and the gray zone has expanded as Russia is moving ever closer to having this route into Guliapolia. And the exact same issue here. You see that Russia are on the flanks already of the north and south, have it close to a semi-cauldron already. It won't take much more until they can get this into a cauldron. And yet again, all the troops that are basically trapped in here are going to be faced with either surrender, death, or withdrawal. And that's another common theme we're going to see repeated again. So now then, let's go up to the big issues here. You see more up the Andriivka area. This is, again, in the last 12 hours, additional Russian control up to this, heading up to this city hill called Pokrovsk. By the way, this is different than the Pokrovsk we've been talking about, but it's yet another town where Russia's moving closer up into. Let's go ahead and move up into the big area we talk about all the time, which is Pokrovsk. So in the northeastern part of Pokrovsk, you see there's yet another area where the Ukraine side has been forced out of. Russia now is in full control over that. And there's hardly any area, just a few streets. And these are like little dachas, little outhouses, a farming community type situation here on the outskirts. There's almost nothing left. By the numbers, I think it's 93%. It's all but effectively been lost by the Ukraine side. And now then Mirnograd. And you see there's been significant escalation in the gray zone of the Mirnograd in this area. It's even worse when you go south. Remember this whole field I kept talking about. Now the entire field is in the gray zone. It appears that the Ukraine side may be trying to withdraw their forces here to get them up into the more defensible areas here, or else Russia is just moving a lot faster. This could well be turning red. Even by tomorrow morning, we'll see how that's going to work out here. The Ukraine side, remember, I told you they had been conducting a tactical counterattack against Rodinska to try and take that back and to free the area to get their troops unbroken out of Mirnograd, but you see that has now failed as well. Now then, this is turning more again back into red. There's still some gray zone up in here, but this area, which had been in the gray zone, has now been retaken by the Russian side. Even more than that, when we get up into the Shakhova pocket right here, this was one of the other areas where the Ukraine side did, for a period of time, push the Russians back. Now that's back into the gray zone. But this Shakhova pocket now is almost completely cut off. Volodymyrovka, that has now been turned from the gray zone into Russian control. And this is almost completely cut off. And so once that's cut off now, again, that'll be yet another of the most recent failures by the Ukraine side. Then up into Konstantinivka, which is the other issue that's just right on the other side of the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd conglomeration. The Russians continue to move south in that, and they're moving up more into the city itself. They have a foothold already. They're moving up further into the south, and that is another area that the Ukraine side just doesn't have any reinforcements. And then up into the other area we talk about a lot is the Kupiansk area. That apparently has not had any major changes. That's all still in the gray zone. That's where it was last time I showed you. So no real move there. Lots of local clashes, but no exchange of territory. However, where there has been significant additions is up here in the Kharkiv area. So this was almost all in the gray zone. Just a little bit of red was up into this area here. Now then, it's all turned into red. New territorial acquisitions here and new gray zones have been pushed out further. What it looks like that Russia is doing, and by the way, there's been some additional advances into Vovchansk. They have pushed south of the city now that for the longest time it was up around this area. It's now moved down south to here. There's a little bit more of the gray zone down in this area, and it looks like that Russia may be preparing to conduct another pincer movement here once they consolidate these areas here. And I would imagine once they complete Vovchansk, and you see they haven't yet, there's still a lot of this area that's still under Ukrainian control. But once they get these territories, then it's entirely possible, if not probable, that Russia will push out at some point around here and at some point around Vovchansk and to try and meet up here with some kind of pincer movements and potentially cut off this entire northern part of the territory of Kharkiv, which will then further isolate the city of Kharkiv. And they have been under relentless attacks against their energy infrastructure, against their military installations, command and control, ammunition depots, etc. It's just been hit really, really hard. And you just see when you look back again at the bottom line, we're talking from the north all the way down to Zaporizhia in the south. There's even still some skirmishes going on around Kherson. That has continued on, although that hasn't gone as far in the last week or so. Hasn't been much at all changed on there, but there are still clashes. You just don't have enough troops to hold all of this stuff. And so the reason why Rybka is sounding the alarm is because some of these areas in the Dnipro Oblast, which is right here, the Russians are in that. You have the Kharkiv area in the north. You still have a toehold in some of the Sumy areas. That still belongs to Russia. They didn't go any further with that, but they still have it. And then all along the front line here, Russia continues to have, according to Zelensky, somewhere around 150,000 additional troops in this area just outside of Pokrovsk, which could be used to reinforce any place that they start to get success here. So the bottom line is that in every way you want to look at this militarily, whether you're talking about politically, economically, strategically, at the strategic military, operationally military, and at the tactical level of military, and most crucially at the manpower level, Russia has an advantage in the drones. They have an advantage in the defense industrial base. They have the big time advantage economically, because all of these sanctions we keep done basically makes them sanction proof and have forced them to find other outlets elsewhere, which are not capable of being sanctioned. So that's easing the difficulty on Russia economically. So everywhere you want to look, and of course, the kingpin on the Russian side also is the manpower. They continue to grow their forces, somewhere around 1.5 million active forces now, over 700,000, but reportedly within the Ukraine side borders, and another 800 or so thousand in Russia training, continuing to rotate troops around. Stanislav, I think, told you about that. They can get in contact for a while, then they can get out, recover, refit, reform, etc. The Ukraine side can't do any of that because they now effectively have no strategic reserves. So if Russia does achieve a breakthrough somewhere, that's going to be it, folks. It's going to be the, so the end could come quickly. We have been inching forward for a long time. But as I said, at some point, mathematics applies. Spin fails to work. And when you have a clash between spin and reality, reality eventually will impose itself and will trump the spin. And we're starting to see that play out now. We can see an acceleration as we get into the rest of this winter, into the next year. We'll certainly keep following all that for you. At the last of this today, before we let you go, I do want to quickly bring you up to date on what's been happening in the potential for a conflict in Venezuela. So we have had some information occur over that over the weekend. I want to bring you up to Trump was asked just a couple of days ago, or I guess maybe it was yesterday. He was asked kind of where are we on things in Venezuela? Here's what he said.
I want to talk. You said Venezuela wants to talk. What does that mean?
Venezuela would like to talk. What does it mean? You tell me. I don't know.
You want to talk to them?
I would. I talk to anybody. I talk to you, right? I talk to anybody. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, that, folks, that's not lending itself to a lot of confidence. You may recall a week or two ago, Trump was asked in the Oval Office. They said, "Hey, sir, turns out that Maduro is begging you. He's been giving you an English language statement. He's basically offering on a silver platter his oil, his gold, his other minerals, etc." And you saw Trump just dismissed it and said, "Yeah, he didn't want to F around with us." You remember him saying, right? It was after that. Then there's been multiple meetings inside the White House about this situation here. The USS Gerald R. Ford, the biggest aircraft carrier in our arsenal, is there. There's lots of other destroyers, missile carriers, marine amphibious units, et cetera, all this stuff down there. News out that Trump has authorized the potential for CIA to conduct operations inside of Venezuela. More events, meetings took place toward the end of last week, and I think even one on Saturday. And yet, now then, he says, okay, I'm willing to talk. But Maduro's been trying to talk. Why are we talking now and when we didn't before? And then that was a really strange statement that he said. Well, what are you going to talk about? Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that the question was because, well, I mean, Maduro's already offered you the stuff and you basically blew it off. So what are you going to talk about? And he's like, I don't know. You tell me. What do you mean? You tell me. You're the president. The only thing that matters is what you say. It doesn't matter what anybody else speculates, not even us. As much as I have a high opinion of the show that we provide and the information we put out there and the observation and analysis, but at the end of the day, it's nothing but an analysis. I don't have any decision-making power. Only the president does. So everyone wants to know, what are you going to talk about? And when he just says, I don't know, I worry that he might mean that, I don't know. I don't know what we're going to talk about here. And that's a little bit more of a significant issue than it may appear. And we're actually going to do, we have a show later this week, and I'll give you more details of that as we get closer. I think it's going to be on Thursday with a doctor, a PhD, and psychologist who says there may be more to just, you know, not just a pejorative or insult that the president is having some cognitive decline, but there are some genuine possibilities that he may actually have some cognitive decline. And this could be one of the evidences of it, because this just doesn't make any sense at all. And the State Department spokesman also had an odd comment over the weekend where someone asked them what the situation with Venezuela was. And here's what they had to say.
No one wants a war with Venezuela. To the extent they're claiming it has something to do with the drug trade coming to the United States, the majority of drugs don't come through the Caribbean. They come via a land route that the president is ignoring because he is so focused on this absurd, illegal military campaign against Venezuela.
Absurd? What's absurd is the claim that he is ignoring the border. We have gone from the worst border crisis in U.S. history under the previous administration to the most secure border in U.S. history under this one. And that directly impacts the ability of these narco-terrorists to smuggle drugs into our country. Not to mention all of the trips the secretary has taken across our region, talking with our partners and allies about ways we can combat these narco-terrorists, working together. And also, the agreements I mentioned regarding the precursors of fentanyl, making sure that they can't fuel this illicit trade. That is absurd from that senator. That is not what we're seeing. This is an all-of-government approach.
Yeah. See, the thing is, though, we're not talking about whether you're controlling the border or not. I'm a fan of that. I thought that was an egregious failure by the previous administration to effectively let the border be open and did very little to stop illegal border crossers. So I'm 100% in support of that. Think that we should have done it a lot longer ago. And that's useful. But when you're talking about the drug issue and a potential war against Venezuela, that's what we're talking about. Is Venezuela one of the kingpins of the, especially the fentanyl, which is the big issue that's affecting the United States, and so many people are being killed from that, by drug overdoses, et cetera. Is Venezuela one of the primary countries? The answer is no. As I've said, depending on what ranking you want to look at, they're somewhere between 16th and 20th in the world. Ironically, China and India are at the very top of that. Mexico, Colombia, it's a lot of others on top of Venezuela. Then the question is, why are you sending the U.S. Gerald R. Ford down to the number 16th in line and not even worrying about all those that are higher if you're worried about fentanyl? That's the question. And why are we talking about the possibility of military conflict with Venezuela, which doesn't make any sense at all? And a matter of fact, when you look at the at a report here, and I want to pull this up real quick, facts about fentanyl smuggling, because he's talking about the border being secure and that somehow is going to stop it. But then you look at the fact that this report can confirm that roughly 4 in 5 people apprehended for smuggling fentanyl into the United States at the southern border between October 2018 and 2024 were U.S. citizens, not Venezuelans. The rest were largely individuals with visas, border crossing cards, or permission to enter the United States lawfully at a point of entry. And let's see if I can go down here. I think it shows this is where their drugs come in. And you see the ports of entry, legal ports of entry, are the primary place where it comes in. Checkpoints, vehicle stops, and then this very small little black area here are between ports of entry, i.e. where some of these alleged drug boats would come in outside the ports of entry. That's not so. So stopping these drug boats has almost no impact whatsoever on all these other categories here. And you're going after the one who's at the bottom of the list on top of, you know, the drawer where the drugs are even coming from at the beginning. That's the big problem here. So when you're talking about where these drugs are coming from, you see that there's a big problem with where we're going to. And then the question is then, why are you using all this military power around Venezuela? Now, my hope is that we say, okay, this is a dumb idea. It's not going to help us. It's not going to work. And yeah, we've sent a lot of folks down there. Let's talk to Maduro. If you're looking for something, what to talk to him about, how's about, what can we do to make sure that there's no attack here? Now, honestly, there really isn't. We don't even have to talk to Maduro. There's no reason at all for the United States to attack Venezuela, period. Our national security is not affected. The drugs hardly have any association at all with Venezuela. There's a lot of others that we could be putting forward. Making border control points stronger, making the points of entry, having better security to be able to check for any kind of illegals coming in or any unauthorized drugs, pardon me. Those are the things. So where the drugs are coming in and we know about them, let's increase this surveillance there to make sure that we can interdict it. That's what's going to make the difference. And of course, if you're actually worried about the drug issue, then we also have to simultaneously get at the demand side of this inside the United States. You can't just say, well, we're going to do everything to just interdict and do nothing to people who were using all these illegal drugs and have the desire to have them and this fentanyl, et cetera. If you're not doing anything to get at the demand side, then you're not serious about an anti-drug situation. That's hard work. And we've tried all this before and had mixed or sometimes no success. But if you're going to try, if you're not going to even try, then that just exposes that you're really not serious about this. And then opens the question, what is the objective here? I don't know. But what we do need to know is that there doesn't need to be any military confrontation. So hopefully the administration will figure this out. We'll shut all this stuff down, bring the ships home. And if you want to put a fig leaf on it and say, well, we talked to Maduro and we figured XYZ out, if you want to get something out of it, I guess you can do that. But as long as there's no military conflict, which would be terrible for the United States, it would be terrible for the people of Venezuela, doesn't need to happen. And it will not help the drug problem, but probably will exacerbate the immigration issue, as there's almost always spillover from these kind of things. That's where we are. That's where we hope to be. We will come and see you at the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. We may have another show for you later this afternoon, somewhere between 2:30 and 3 p.m. on where things are in the U.S. politics, especially in regard to the where we are now after the shutdown, and are we heading into another shutdown? What's going on with the ever popular or ever unpopular issue with the I just went blank. I can't believe I did that on the Epstein files. Sorry. How did I miss that one? That's like it all roiling a lot of things, and all this stuff is kind of intermixed here. We may, if we can bring some stuff together, we're going to have that for you this afternoon. But in any case, do remember that we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. I know a lot of people really dig the podcast style of this, and we encourage you to go there if that's what you like, or share it with somebody else. Because as we say a lot, we're unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth, whatever it is. And you know, folks, you're watching our show. You don't get what we give you on very many other channels, because we're giving you the no kidding truth, because we care about the American people. We care about all the people. We're going to give it to you. Make sure you share it with somebody else who may need to have it. Thanks very much, folks. And we'll see you this afternoon with the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.